Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
White riots at the center of empire. With the rise of the Trump presidency, few events were more remarkable than the 2017 white nationalist rallies in Charlottesville, Virginia. Here we saw the naked face of white hatred, fear, and anxiety, seemingly inspired by a presidency brought into being in part by the false claim that the nation's first black president wasn't born in the U.S. Who could guess that less than 4 years later, another white riot would erupt, this time at the nation's capital, the halls of Congress, where yet another false claim, that of a stolen election, would provide the spark to a flame of insurrection. These two furious events form bookends of time, a four-year period of a presidential term marking the malice unleashed by Trump. They also provide insight into white entitlement, the deep-seated belief that public space is white space. They attacked the Capitol in the light of day, shattering windows and crashing through doors. They beat cops like drums, whipped them with batons, sticks, and flagpoles, and dragged them down steps. And they did so on camera. One cop was later interviewed and said he was being assaulted at the Capitol by protesters who said they liked and supported police, especially during summer conflicts with groups like Black Lives Matter. The cop remarked that many of the Capitol protesters suffered from what he called cognitive dissonance. But guess what? Among those attacking Congress were active duty and retired cops from across America. Amazing. Trump played the role of America's Caligula, the Roman emperor, vain, petty, cruel, mean, who strived to humiliate Roman senators, who hated all of those who would not worship him, ruled for 4 years until his armed guards dispatched him. King Trump waged war against Congress and earned himself his second impeachment for incitement to insurrection. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Rough 2021. There we go. No errors. Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, January 26th, 2021. So I have been told. That was Mumia Abu-Jamal. Beginning of the broadcast, talking about the Capitol siege that happened just a few weeks back. Just before we went live, I saw that the Senate rejected the motion to dismiss the impeachment charges against former President Trump. So they will proceed second impeachment hearings beginning sometime in the beginning part of February. When I saw all of the violence, the melee in the nation's capital just a few days back, I immediately thought of the book we are discussing this here evening. It is not a brand new book. This didn't come out, you know, within the last couple of years, published in 2002, but I thought of it immediately. And then when I went back and reread it in preparing for the program, my goodness, there are so many parallels. I cannot wait to just put this book up next to what happened in D.C. Context. That is in the name of the broadcast for a reason. Context. No surprise at all. And in fact, I would even say I've had this book for a while, published in 2002. I think we maybe were supposed to read this right now. Maybe. I got halfway through. O.J. Simpson is mentioned in the book. Aren't we reading that on the book club? Like a book that is mostly focused on mob, white mob violence and lynching in the 19th and 20th century U.S. O.J. Simpson even pops up there. The book club. O.J. Simpson, Mark Furman coming to the witness stand Thursday in the book club. So excited. But even the juice in the book we're talking about this evening. And we got lots. And I mean, anybody, if you have listened to the context of white supremacy, this book is just, you will hear lots and lots of names of people in events that you are very familiar with. Paul Robeson, the Moores Ford Bridge lynching, Claude Neal. We talked about that lynching in Florida so many times. Booker T. Washington, the Red Summer of 1919, the North Carolina Wilmington coup of 1898, the film Birth of a Nation, Ida B. Wells Barnett, the legend Pitchfork Ben Tillman. Can I get one of my favorite quotes from Ben Tillman? The threat of Negro domination hangs over us like the sword of Damocles. The legend Pitchfork Ben Tillman have to be included on the broadcast. And even we're reading O.J. Simpson in the current book club, but we just finished Cased. Isabel Wilkerson's Cased mentions the book we're discussing this evening in the text. I mentioned that in the book club. Our guest joining us this evening live, he is a faculty member at the New School in New York, an award-winning author of a number of different books. He is a fellow of the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU. The book we're discussing this evening, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. Lots of very constructive, revealing information about the history of white terrorism in the U.S. And in fact, one of his other books seems like it might be related, maybe I'm wrong, to what we're talking about, The Fair Chase, The Epic Story of Hunting in America. Maybe, maybe not. We'll see. So thankful to have him on the program. Joining us live, Professor Philip Dre. Professor Dre, you with us, sir?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your Tuesday evening. We are so excited to have you and to talk about your book, At the Hands of Persons Unknown, for our listeners. I'm sure we have some folks this might be the first time hearing about you and the work that you do. If you'd like to give kind of a brief intro before we get started.
Well, the book At the Hands of Persons Unknown, you know, the expression At the Hands of Persons Unknown was in the case of lynchings in the 19th century, and in the early 20th century, that was often part of the coroner's verdict, was that the victim had, you know, died at the hands of persons unknown. And of course, we see that echoed a little bit in what we just saw in Washington a week or so ago. It has to do with, what is a mob? Is it a bunch of individuals? Does it take on a personality or a character of its own in which individuals lose their autonomy, basically? And that was kind of the idea of that verdict by the coroner in lynchings of African Americans historically, was to say that death had come at the hands of persons unknown. In other words, we don't know who did this. The community did this. It was a way of absolving people of culpability and also of making the incident sort of not really exist. In other words, you defied the courts. There was no trial. There was no due process. There was no transcripts or anything. And At the Hands of Persons Unknown became this kind of euphemism for the kind of muteness of the white mob, basically. And I think you saw that again a little bit with the aftermath of what we saw a few weeks ago. In other words, like, who's responsible? Who's, you know, there's a lot of finger pointing. Were they the Oath Keepers? Were these just excited Trump supporters? Who were they exactly? And of course, no one really wants to take responsibility. And that was very much an echo of the institution, really, of lynching as it existed in the 19th and early 20th century here.
Lots of parallels. The mobocratic spirit, great line in the book, very much alive. They say racism is alive and well. The mobocratic spirit, alive and well in Washington.
You should note that, we should note that that phrase came from Abraham Lincoln, basically. In 1838, it had to do with the birth of the abolition movement. And the Southern reaction to the abolition movement was that people began it was often, things like tar and feathering, driving people out of town, but basically the actions of a mob as a way to direct public policy, basically. And people were sometimes put to death. Otherwise, they were publicly shamed or driven away or what have you. And Abraham Lincoln was then just a young attorney in Illinois. And he gave a speech saying, I call this the mobocratic spirit. We can't have this in our country. In other words, he was warning us about something that, again, we saw just a couple of weeks ago in Washington. That's the mobocratic spirit. It's replacing the making of politics or public policy with the actions of a mob. It's frightening to see. It's interesting for me as a historian of mobs in America, to actually see it, the way those videos captured what happened in the Capitol a couple weeks ago, you just see the visceral intensity of it, the violence of it, the anger that people had. You saw it, on the line where they're confronting the Capitol police, just this vicious, vicious anger and hostility. And you see that, of course, when it's multiplied thousands of times in a mob that size, you really get a sense of how frightening that phenomenon is.
Quoting Ben Tillman one more time, if you scratch the white man too deep, you will find the same savage whose ancestry used to roam wild in Britain when the Danes and Saxons first crossed over. He has many great lines in the book. He would have fit right in with the crowd. Pitchfork Ben Tillman. For our listeners who this might be their first time hearing from you, they have not seen you. Professor Dre, you are a white man. Is that correct?
That's right. Yes.
This program, Context of White Supremacy, I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. Mm-hmm. I use them as synonyms. Same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Well, it's interesting because that term white supremacy meant something different about half a century ago. When I've written books about the modern civil rights movement, at that time a white supremacist was someone who was like a Pitchfork Ben Tillman. It was someone who was like a statesman or a politician who practiced racist policy or believed in white supremacy and sort of tried to enact laws to that end or to enforce the dominance of the white race. And so that term to me has a kind of historical echo. It had a slightly different meaning at that time. But yes, your definition makes sense, especially in our current the way the world is today. Of course, we see that there is this kind of white hegemony, that's a line of tension, of course, obviously.
I'm only asking this question because you do mention briefly, and I mean one time, it's super brief, but it is mentioned, O.J. Simpson in the book, and we are in the middle of reading about O.J. Simpson for reasons that don't really have anything to do with this book, but do you have an opinion on his guilt, the 1994 double murders, O.J. Simpson? You think he was guilty, innocent?
It's funny because I don't remember the context in which it's mentioned in At the Hands of Persons Unknown. You're saying that it appears in that book. And I mean, I wrote the book, so I should remember. But I wrote the book that's like 20 years ago, so I may have forgotten exactly. My sense of I don't have to know to answer your question. I mean, my sense of the O.J. Simpson trial, it's funny because my father at the time was totally obsessed with it. He watched every minute of it. But I didn't, I was busy at the time. I didn't really watch it. Like a lot of people, I think I was surprised by the verdict. I had always assumed he was guilty, I guess because he ran away in the blazer and, you know, was followed by the helicopter. And he said, remember the way I used to be. And I mean, he seemed to almost be kind of confessing at first when they captured him. So I always assumed that it was kind of a, you know, a done deal that he was going to be convicted. I do think that probably, I mean, imagine at the time, this was, wasn't original to my way of thinking, but I think obviously there was a lot of displeasure from black jurors and from the black community writ large at the way the trial was handled and the way in which the white police and the prosecution of O.J. were depicted. And of course, it didn't hurt that O.J. had a really great, like his dream team of attorneys, some of the best in the country. I was just personally, I was surprised by it, but I can't say I was like a student of the trial at the time it was going on. So I didn't follow it every moment. I know a lot of people predicted he might be acquitted. Others, you know, whatever, didn't think about it so much. I do remember at that time, I guess it was 1994, 1995. It was, you know, the way it was received by the, you know, at least the white public, I think there was a lot of surprise that he had been acquitted. Maybe it was not so much in the black community. Maybe they thought they had seen, they anticipated that a bit more. Of course, now there's been at least two documentaries, I believe, about the case. I saw part of one of them. But yeah, I don't know if you went around and asked people, I don't know, what do other people, you say you're immersed in the subject now a little bit. Have you found that people are, most people feel that he got off or that he was wrongly accused in the first place?
I know I, like you, I did not follow the trial at the time. I was still a child at the time of the 95 criminal trial. So I didn't pay attention. I just assumed he was guilty because everyone else said he was guilty. It seemed like to me, although I didn't watch any, like not 5 minutes of the trial. I didn't read anything about it. I had zero detail about it at all. I just kind of softly assumed by osmosis, because so many other people seemed to think he was guilty, I thought he was guilty too. Right. And in fact, I didn't grasp that until we started reading our current book. And I started just getting just small bits of information like, oh, Mark Furman was the guy who found the, or the, he hopped the fence to get the glove with no search for just things like that. Like, wow, I would have maybe thought twice about just saying, oh, yeah, he did it. And moving, I would have maybe thought a little bit. But we've had a lot of folks who said, a lot of black people who said that they just assumed he was guilty all this time and they hadn't really dug into too many of the details. And then now starting to look at it, many things stand out as, wow, that would give me a lot of reason to question whether or not he did this. And even some of the things that we talk about in this book with the police conduct and how easy it is to, in fact, O.J. Simpson would have been lynched if this had happened in 1940, 1930. It wouldn't have been Club Don't Fit. He would have been lynched and we would all move forward. No drama, all the rest of it. But I might even, in fact, just because of the book that we're reading, they mention Emmett Till at the end of the book. So I do have to swing back one more because you all have more common thread with O.J. Simpson that I want to get your thought on. But that's getting to the end. So I want to start off. There's so many parallels with what we have seen just in the last few days in a book that you wrote 20 years ago. I'm starting purposely in the middle of your book because I don't like it when people try to act like white supremacy racism is just a down south thing and it's just below the Mason-Dixon contraire mon frères. So I'm deliberately starting in the middle of your book, and because I so easily forget before we got to the Capitol siege, it's not like all this just happened blindly. There was no warning. There was lots leading up to this. One of the things that was leading up to this, white people plotted to kidnap and execute the governor in Michigan, white woman, Gretchen Whitmer. This was back in December before we even got to that. So I pivot to chapter 8, and you write, in Detroit, May 1925, a black physician named Ozian Sweet and his wife Gladys bought a home on the corner of Garland and Charlevoix Avenues in a predominantly white neighborhood. When they moved in on September 8th, they immediately began receiving threatening phone calls. The next night, Dr. Sweet took his 2-year-old daughter to stay with Gladys's mother while he and his wife, his 2 brothers, Otis, a dentist, and Henry, a student at Wilberforce, and several friends, attempted to have supper in the house. Early in the evening, a white crowd gathered outside, catcalling, cursing, and occasionally pelting the residents with rocks. Police on hand made no attempt to intervene. Suddenly, shots were fired from a window in the house. 2 whites were struck. 1, Leon E. Briner, was shot in the back, mortally wounded. Police rushed into the house, arrested everyone present, and charged them with murder. Black attorneys hired by Gladys Sweet's mother were allowed to speak with the prisoners only after they had been held incommunicado for 2 days, and one of the lawyers contacted NAACP headquarters in New York to explain the unique circumstances of the case. I'm moving down a little bit. When the trial got started, when the trial got underway, the prosecution produced 71 witnesses who testified that the group gathered outside the Sweet House on the night of September 9 that had not constituted a threatening mob. Sweet initially said there were about 2,000 people outside his house. Some of the prosecution witnesses stated there were as few as 15 or 20. That's quite a sweep. 2015. Mm-hmm. this way was a key point because, as Judge Frank Murphy told the jury, under Michigan law, 12 or more persons armed with clubs or 30 unarmed persons were considered to constitute an unlawfully gathered mob. The prosecutors tried to paint a picture of a quiet evening along Garland Avenue in which neighbors sat on their porches discussing the weather, and friends stopped to chat on their way home from the grocery store, while a few mischievous boys threw stones at the Sweet House. Into this relatively innocuous scene, the state contended the blacks had, without provocation, opened fire. Based on the varying accounts, Darrow believed that approximately 500 people were present in the dark outside the Sweet Home, and through cross-examination, he was able to show that many of the witnesses had been coached by a police detective to use the word few in describing the number of people on hand. His most effective witness was Philip Adler, a white reporter from the Detroit Free Press, who said that there were so many people he could barely force his way across the street, and that when he did, he was told by someone in the crowd, "A Negro family has moved in here and we're going to get them out." I will stop there. They were just going to kidnap the governor of Michigan. Mobocratic spirit. Just, can you give a bit more detail? Because I think this is a great incident. Black people actually fighting back, and connections of what we're seeing right now in Michigan, no less.
Well, the thing about the Ossie and Sweet case, of course, that became one reason it's so important historically is, of course, it looked very bad for him and his family because they had shot out of the house. A white man was killed, and they were held incommunicado. But who came to their defense? No other than Clarence Darrow, one of the most famous attorneys in America, came to their defense with the help of the NAACP. And it was a huge trial in Detroit, got lots and lots of press attention. And at the end, the Sweet family was acquitted. Clarence Darrow gave a very powerful argument that if a mob surrounds a house of people and threatens them, the people in the house have a right to be frightened and concerned, and that was why they, in other words, that they fired out of their house a gun, and a man was killed. And so, it actually surprised a lot of people that the Ossian Sweet, was acquitted. And you know, there have been echoes of that case. There was a case just here on Long Island in New York about maybe 10, 12 years ago, a very similar case, where a young black teenager had gotten into a fight with a white teenager. And the white teenager and his friends chased him home. And the black teenager took, he tried to take shelter in his family's house. And this white group of white toughs were kind of hanging out outside threatening, and the father of the black boy came out and shot and killed one of the white people who were threatening the house. And he also was acquitted. In other words, they basically said, if your own house, your dwelling, is being threatened by a mob, that, you know, Ossian Sweet was within his rights, basically, to defend his family. He felt threatened. So that case was very important. And now, of course, the Gretchen Whitmer thing, one reason that's being talked about a lot is that that turns out to be kind of a prelude for what happened at the Washington Capitol. I mean, I think like a lot of people, it sounds like you agree with me, is that when we heard about this plan to kidnap the governor of Michigan, we were astounded. Like, what are you crazy? What's going on here? You know, this is a whole different dimension. And sure enough, you know, 2 months later, we have this thing happen at the Capitol in Washington. Also, like, you know, you're rubbing your eyes. Like, I can't believe I'm seeing this. This is like people, like a mob invades the Capitol while it's in session. Congress is in session. You know, so it's like, it has that in common. It's like this. And of course, that's what we're all so frightened about right now, is because where do we go from here with this? You know, these things that are unbelievable, threatening to kidnap a governor and then invading the U.S. Capitol, like, where, you know, what's going to happen? I don't know if you saw just today, of course, you know, the Republicans in the Senate are acting like they don't want to convict Trump. You know, they're going to try to let this get, it's like nothing to see here. They want the whole impeachment thing just like, eh, just like it happened the last time. I mean, what does it take? Like, you know what I mean? Like, what has to happen for this, you know what I mean, for them to turn on Trump? They won't. They're afraid because they're afraid of the mob. That's what it is, the MAGA people, this whole, that's what they're scared of. They don't want to intimidate them. That's their, you know, whatever. They don't want to intimidate the Trump base. So, I mean, that's where we're at. So it's like you're pointing to some really important, this is like this continuum you're pointing to is really, really disturbing.
Hopefully people will, you know, make some of those connections. Context of white supremacy, I think another important thread, at least something we've emphasized here for our 12 years of broadcasting, the role of white women. So many of the reports that I've seen about what happened in Washington, D.C. and white supremacy in general, it is cast as white men, white male patriarchy, white men are responsible for this. And I've said for a long time, you would not have a system of white supremacy without white women. You have and even in Washington, D.C., there were a number of white women in that crowd. It was not just white men. You have a number of phenomenal incidents in the book. I said I'm going to try to pick one that just gives some great. I'm just picking this one because there are photographs with this one that I hadn't seen before, even though we just read a biography on Paul Robeson. So to see some new photos of Peekskill. So you're right.
Oh, yeah.
August 27, which is almost in line with the March on Washington, August 28, a few years later. But anyway, August 27, right-wing demonstrators, many of whom had been drinking, stormed into the concert grounds and attacked the 100 or so people who had gathered to picnic before the concert, including numerous families. Caught with the picnickers were 35 or 40 volunteers who had come early to set up the bandstand and folding chairs using rocks, clubs, and fists. The demonstrators staged several assaults on the crowd. A small number of police were on hand but stood by and made no effort. Did I hear that again? No effort to intervene as the mob cursed their adversaries as commies and Jews and proclaimed, "We're Proud Boys. I mean, Hitler's boys. We're going to get Robeson. Lynch Robeson. Give us Robeson." At least three times, concert workers braved the gauntlet to get out to payphone and place calls to the state police, but no help was forthcoming. A later investigation found that despite the obvious threat of violence, the pre-concert requests from the Robeson forces for adequate police protection, only six officers had been detailed to the concert site. The singer himself never showed up. Like many others attempting to get to the concert, Robeson arrived to find a mob blocking the road into the picnic grounds. Intercepted by William Patterson of the CRC, he was quickly escorted away to safety. The writer Howard Fast, known for his novels about American history and citizen heroes such as Tom Paine, was among those defending the stage area. He recalled that there were well over 500 of the fascists. In the next half hour, they attacked us twice without breaking our ranks. They had worked themselves into a screaming alcoholic frenzy, and they repeated their threats that no one would leave the picnic grounds alive. He remembered most of them were prosperous appearing men, well set up, well dressed real estate men, grocery clerks, lunch counter attendants, filling station hands, and more of the kind. Throw in a couple of hundred decent citizens, 100 teenagers whose heads were filled with anti-communist sewage, add 100 pillars of the local Catholic Church, half 100 college students home on vacation, half 100 workers drawn along, and 200 or 300 of the sweepings of the filth of that whole Hudson River section, and you have a good idea of what we faced that night. The concert proceeded virtually without incident, although trouble waited outside. The mob, unable to assault the patrons inside because of the tightened security, spread themselves along the country roads leading away from the site, and armed with rocks, bottles, and other missiles, bombarded cars, and buses as they departed the concert. We saw children, women bleeding, blood all over the road. Robeson's son, Paul Jr., later said, the road was eventually slick with blood, just like a war. He recalled that entire families, age 10 to age 70, appeared to have turned out to attack the concert goers, screaming epithets, throwing rocks, expressing that hate. Police and state troopers joined in the harassment. Some of the most disturbing news photographs of the violence are those showing 14 and 15 year old girls standing side by side with uniformed lawmen. Can I read that again? Some of the most disturbing news photographs of the violence are those showing 14 and 15 year old girls standing side by side with uniformed lawmen as together they scream and spit at the Robeson fans. It was a very tense atmosphere. Veteran New York reporter Gabe Pressman admitted, I'd been in the war, been in combat, and I was shocked. I didn't think there was that much hatred in the country at the hands of persons unknown. I will stop there. We had read about Paul Robeson before, but wow, the role.
You know, you
go ahead, sir.
You did a very beautiful reading. One thing I was thinking while you were reading was, of course, we just heard 2 weeks ago when Raphael Warnock was running for Senate in Georgia, they were calling him, saying he was a socialist and a communist. You know, it's the same. It's like a little bit of an echo of what they were accusing that riot in Peekskill in the late 40s. It had to do with not just race, but of course also because they thought Robeson and his ilk were commies. And of course, it was that time of the Red Scare in America when people were freaked out. You know, and I just thought it was so odd that this has come. That even that has come back a little bit too. This business about their, you know, Raphael Warnock and other people on the left are going to bring communism or socialism, whatever it is. I mean, it's the same old bugaboo, basically, from time gone by. And it echoes that a little bit. But no, you depict the ropes. And I think there's a photograph in the book, I think the one you're referring to, of basically teenage girls with highway patrolmen standing next to them, you know, like making rude gestures at Robeson and his fans and stuff. But that was really a horrific incident that happened close to New York City, and people fled back to New York basically in buses. And you can imagine how frightening that is. It's a little bit like what the Freedom Riders went through in the early 60s. You know, imagine being on a bus surrounded by a hostile mob that's banging on the bus. They could set it on fire. You don't know what's going to happen. And you're stuck in, you know, you can't move. You're in this vehicle and so on. You know, it's terrifying. And that's what a lot of these Peekskill people, the crowd that gone to see Robeson perform, that's what they experienced there. Very much a very dark day in the history of really a kind of an outlying area of New York City, really. Peekskill is not very far away. So, it's interesting you bring that up. That's the mobocratic spirit at work once again. We can trace it throughout American history. I mean, one thing I should point out, you know, it's interesting is that a lot of the white, you keep referring to the white men, white supremacy, but, you know, this was, it's just as today, what is the underlying issue? It is the white fear of being replaced by a sort of majority-minority America that is no longer a white-dominated country. And in a certain way, those were the same fears that motivated the attacks on black people in the 19th and early 20th century throughout the South and also in the North. It had to do with this fear that the, you know, the generation of black Americans post-slavery, these were people who had not grown up with enslavement. They were mobile. They were moving to large cities. They were, you know, trying to realize their citizenship rights as they had every right to. And this was very intimidating and frightening to white people and white men in particular. And that's, again, it was the same kind of, that same kind of resistance in a very large sense to this a widespread social and racial change, transition that made white men uncomfortable, and they didn't know how to deal with it. And this is the result. And it's, in other words, there are these, it's very much a kind of bookend thing. It's not something that's completely different. We see the same kind of, very much, many of the same elements are there.
Absolutely. Before I pitch to my next question, just if you could give a bit more detail, because I think it's so critically important. And you list not just the white women's role in the attack on Paul Robeson, but even in the Emmett Till case, Carolyn Bryant's role, just the role, because frequently white women are sanitized from these lynching episodes, when frequently they were a huge, even in Wilmington, you talk about they were a huge rallying point, like white supremacy must protect us white women, and sometimes even being involved in these lynching mobs. Can you talk about their role and even how they've been sanitized from this participation?
Well, this is a very important part, of course, especially of historic lynching in the 19th century and early 20th century in America, is the role, this whole idea of the white, the sanctity of the white woman was very central to what you might call the lynching ethos, if there was such a thing. In other words, what the idea was is that where this comes from, I believe, was that the white men had for so long a time had sexual access to black women that they developed, first of all, a guilt complex about it, and secondly, they tended to then think that any consensual relations between black men and white women must also then be non-consensual. And so hence their hostility toward black men who were involved in any kind of relationship with a white woman. At the same time, white men tended to raise white women, their own wives, up on a pedestal and make them kind of sacred and pure. And so there arose this kind of a sort of a myth or a belief that white women must be protected and at all costs. They were sort of the epitome of innocence and purity and good. And from this, that's kind of what you were referring to. And for that reason, even when a lynching was not a result of any kind of like relationship between a black man and a white woman, that was often added into the mix, just as a way to kind of incite the mob. In other words, that was like a sure go-to. You could always, even if the dispute had to do with wages or land or the ownership of livestock, say, whites might often throw in an accusation of a sexual transgression by a black man to basically make sure as a way to incite people. And so that's why that became very pivotal. So the role of the white woman as this kind of the sort of the victim and heroine who was being protected by the actions of the mob. That's in her name it was being done. And, of course, what's interesting is that one of the most effective anti-lynching groups in the 1930s was called the Association of Southern Women for the Prevention of Lynching. Basically, this was a group of white women who came forward and said, wait a minute, stop doing this horrific thing in our name. We don't need white men, we don't need you to protect us from something that is, first of all, it's mostly in your imagination anyway. And so they began monitoring whenever a black man was arrested and put in jail for any reason. The white women from this association would hound the sheriff and say, that man better be there in the morning. We don't want you turning him over to a group of white hoodlums who come around looking for him or whatever you're going to do. In other words, they were very effective because they were the ones who were the nominal sort of recipients of what of this kind of lynching ethos. Like, well, this lynching, and you know, the truth is it's a very sad commentary on even people, a lot of people, white people in America who knew better, kind of for a very long time accepted this idea that, well, lynching was kind of necessary because otherwise you would have this kind of, you know, outrage going on all the time of, like, you know, black men seeking sexual relations with white women. And that was the very idea that someone like Ida B. Wells, one reason why she's justifiably famous, is she was one of the first people to puncture that and say, wait a minute, this is a bunch of hogwash. This is just being, this is like a myth that's being perpetrated and used to support this sort of pogrom, really, in a way. I mean, when you look at the large number of lynchings that took place, like, say, in the 1890s, they were happening, you know, maybe twice a week, basically. You know, that was her point. Ida B. Wells was the first, you know, she came out and said, this is a lie. It's not really true. And that's really the birth of the anti-lynching crusade in America, started it with her in the 1890s. Eventually, the NAACP picked it up. You know, the NAACP, they were founded in 1910. Their first big cause was anti-lynching because they saw that was the most obvious, egregious, and barbarous act, and that it had to be confronted if anything was to be done. And so, that's kind of gets at this recurring thing about the white woman being the kind of, again, the sort of, like, you'll often hear that the sanctity of the white woman kind of mentioned in conjunction with lynchings and mob violence. And that was often thing. And you're right to say that sometimes white women themselves would then be active in these mobs, often egging them on or even participating. Sometimes they would be allowed to be sort of, in other words, they or their family might be allowed to assist in somehow meting out some kind of punishment to the accused man as an act, just sort of a personal vengeance kind of thing. So, I mean, it was a very, you know, remember, a lot of lynchings were spectacles. They weren't carried out at midnight in the dark. They were large public events attended by thousands of people. And so there was often a certain amount of what you might call staging, really, of these events for public consumption. And they might very well include the aggrieved party, so to speak, having some role in it.
Context of white supremacy. I was going to ask about one of my favorite films, Birth of a Nation, but you said the word consumption. Our book club some years back, one of my favorite books, top 10, The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism in U.S. Slave Culture by Vincent Woodard. Spectacular book. And they have a whole chapter devoted to the lynching of Claude Neal, where they made him eat his own penis and all the rest of it. Auto cannibalism. He talks about so many of the different, whether it's literal consumption of black enslaved bodies, whether it's metaphorical, whether it's auto-consumption, making you eat your own penis, that sort of thing. Even he talked about them storing a black male's genitals in a pickle jar and keeping that on the dish, like this connotation with food and eating. He even said when they talk about slaves, when you condition a slave, you brutalize them and beat them so that they will behave act in a more acquiescent manner. They call that seasoning. He said, you normally season food so it has a specific taste. Why is all of this connected with food and consumption? So much of your book reminded me of Delectable Negro. In fact, there's a portion where you quote the scholar Orlando Patterson, who I think is a black male, and he gets right to all of this. He says, This is from chapter two of the book with Orlando Patterson, where he writes, let me make sure I get the correct quote. Patterson also stresses, chapter three, apologies. Patterson also suggests, Patterson also stresses the suggestions of cannibalistic ritual in lynchings. It cannot be coincidence that the South's most popular outdoor entertainment spectacle, the barbecue, in which pigs, cows, or sheep were roasted and served picnic style, was also the term commonly used for the spectacle lynchings of black people. As a cookout, human victims were also butchered and roasted, often with members of the crowd offering suggestions on technique. The act of castration, a horrifying component of many lynchings, was at least mechanically familiar to most Southern participants, men accustomed to the slaughter of fowl and livestock and such practices as the gelding of horses. While attendees at lynchings did not take away a plate of food, the experience of having witnessed the event was thought by many incomplete if one did not go home with some piece of cooked human being, and there is much anecdotal evidence of lynch crowds either consuming food and drink while taking part in the execution or retiring en masse immediately afterward for a meal, or in the case of a notorious immolation in Pennsylvania in 1911, ice cream sundaes. Even the victims seemed occasionally to join in with the spirit of the occasion. The Negroes met their death with remarkable fortitude, noted a news account of a multiple execution in the turn of the century, Georgia. They sang and drank lemonade and joked with the sheriff. Just, can you speak to this, comparing the lynching and killing of black people with some sort of food consumption?
It's funny, I haven't heard that passage in a long time, and that you cited Orlando Patterson also writes about this as well. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
You know, when you were reading, what I was thinking of too was that, you know, until 1908, there was photographic postcards of lynchings were allowed to be sent through the U.S. mail, which was also a huge, I mean, you touched on this a bit. What you're talking about are relics of lynching, and this was a very odd and sick feature of lynchings, which is that it could be a hideous relic from the victim himself. It also could be a piece of bark from a tree or a piece of the rope that had restrained the black victim. Or it could be a photograph, a postcard made of the lynch victim, of the crowd, something to do with the event. And that is one of the most psychologically difficult and perplexing aspects of the lynching phenomenon, is this idea that you very eloquently read that passage, this need to somehow come away with something from it, a keepsake of sorts. Either it could be a hideous keepsake, or it could be, like I said, something tangential to it. But it was a very powerful motive, and you saw it played out repeatedly. It's interesting because the frenzy that would follow a lynching for relics was often as intense as the lynching itself. And the other thing I'll mention that, of course, is even more disturbing, perhaps, is that sometimes the mob could not be satisfied by the lynching of just one person, and would become so worked up they would then turn on the black community at large. And this happened frequently, and it, often with devastating results, obviously, of not only people being hurt or killed, but also stores, homes being destroyed, fire being set, this type of thing. Of course, we've heard of these incidents throughout American history. And again, you know, it's funny, I keep coming back to these images that emerged from the Capitol a few weeks ago that we all saw. You see that intensity of them. You see that. That's one thing about those images. You know, we've all heard about mobs throughout American history and the history of the world, basically. But when those videos from the Capitol, you really see it. You see it up close, that intensity, that anger, and you you get a sense of the force it would represent, and how, you know, a lot of people, a lot of the 19th century lynchings that I've studied, in fact, what the one comment that many people make is always, there's nothing you could have done to stop it. It was unstoppable, that type of thing. And you got that sense from watching that thing at the Capitol, like these people, you know, pushing against the cops, et cetera, just kept on coming, getting in the door, through the windows, you know, this just like force that you would not want to be that person delegated to try to stop that. And you saw how overwhelming it could be. And I think that's, again, that's kind of what you're alluding to in these readings. You're that sense of this force that's just overwhelming and egregious and barbaric in every way.
Context of white supremacy, just with the whole consumption and these acts of barbarism and white terrorism as some form of consumption of black flesh, literally or metaphorically. You're writing about the talk about police terrorism and incidents of police brutality and all the rest. Robert Charles in Louisiana has a shootout. He kills a number of enforcement officials, and the retaliation is swift and brutal. Eventually, after they kill him, you write, Charles' remains were buried secretly in a potter's field to the particular distress of a carnival owner who had offered a large sum for the cadaver with the promise that he would pickle and display it at the Archfiend of the Century. Display it as the Archfiend of the Century. Again, you normally pickle foods. Very interesting language around this brutality. And again, it's so peculiar because you generally don't see this sort of behavior, I'm not aware, with other people. It's fascinating on a number of levels. Speaking of fascinating, one of the parallels that I hadn't really processed a lot until I read your book, we've talked a bunch about Jack Johnson on the program, former heavyweight boxing champion. We've talked about Birth of a Nation many, many times, Gus the Renegade and all of that. It wasn't until I was reading your book and saying, some of this contribute, because I knew they had white mobs and all of that. Some of the times after Jack Johnson fights, he would win. They would go out and take it out on other black people. I knew that. And I knew Birth of a Nation, white people would go and, oh, yes, kill Gus. And they would shoot their guns in the theater and all that. But I was not connecting with, oh, that is a part of this mob spirit. And I even looked at things for right now when you have a substantial number of white people, even our former president, who have complained about uppity black athletes who are taking a knee and Black Lives Matter and talking about racism and trying to get people to vote. It seems there are a lot of white people who have the same sentiments now that white people did 100 years ago about Jack, although for different reasons, but the same sense, uppity black athletes and entertainers who don't know their place is a part of this spirit of agitation. Can you touch on that and specifically about Birth of a Nation and Jack Johnson, how that contributed to this mob spirit?
Well, of course, Birth of a Nation was the huge 1915 W.G. Griffith film, which was one of the first like large-scale epic movies. And technically, it was sort of overwhelming to people. You know, remember that at that time, very few people had really seen a movie at all. And they were so naive about it that when, you know, in the movie, when a train is coming toward the camera, they think it's actually coming at them. I mean, this kind of thing. And so they were very caught up in this film, The Birth of a Nation.
Got disconnected. Usual suspects. I'm getting Professor Dre back with us. Birth of a Nation, caught up in it. Wouldn't be a broadcast if we didn't have some tech issues of some sort. Let's see. Have Professor Dre.
Hello.
Oh, okay. We got disconnected, Professor Dre. Not sure what happened.
Oh, that's
we lost
okay.
you. Right with Birth of a Nation. You said they didn't know the train wasn't real.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was saying that the film itself was a technological wonder. In fact, even W.E.B. Du Bois said he kind of liked the movie for its all the Civil War scenes and that kind of thing. But, of course, it depicted a version of Reconstruction, which was very racist and prejudicial. And so the NAACP boycotted the film, tried to have it shut down. They didn't get what they wanted. I was going to say, ironically, what some black theater owners did who show the film is they attached to the end of the film the fight films of Jack Johnson. You know, in those days before TV, they would make movies of big heavyweight prize fights because those could be shown to people for money. And so those films of Jack Johnson beating white opponents were then shown at the end of Birth of a Nation in black theaters, because black people, having had to sit through this movie that depicted black Americans in a rather unfavorable light, then they got to see like 5 minutes of Jack Johnson, this good-looking black athlete, pummeling white opponents and winning. So it was, that just goes to speak how his notoriety was quite huge. It wasn't just because he was a successful black boxer and beat white opponents, which was one thing, but he had the audacity to marry a white woman as well, which then, of course, that was really like going around the bend, so to speak. And he wound up actually leaving the country. I don't remember not exactly. He lived in Mexico for many years. And he felt he was unsafe here in the States, and he was afraid they'd put him in jail and so on. So, but you're right to connect that in a way with Colin Kaepernick and what's going on. I mean, you know, you're right. The black football players who take a knee, they've also been subjected to all kinds of criticism and harassment. So, nothing new there.
Shut up and dribble. I think they even LeBron James was told, like, we don't want to hear anything from you. Again, uppity black athletes being a major part of what we've seen. And I think most of the professional sports leagues have reported a dip in ratings, the NBA, the NFL. And they said at least they think some. I mean, it's lots of things happening, the health pandemic and all the rest of it. But at least some folks have said they think a part of that is because a substantial number of white people are not pleased. Shut up and dribble. We're not interested in you taking a knee and all the rest of it, talking about racism.
There's always been this weird thing in American sports to a certain extent, especially certain sports like, say, basketball, where a large number of the athletes are black and a large part of the viewership is white. So you always have this kind of weird dynamic. You know, not so much maybe in football as well, not so much in baseball, but I think in basketball particularly, you have that, you know, that kind of strange tension or that's always been there. You know, I've always thought that was something that, you know, was potentially explosive. Of course, it did happen in football with Colin Kaepernick, but I don't know. We'll see. It's hard with the pandemic to tell how much what is affecting the attendance or the viewership. I don't know how permanent or serious that would be. You know, we live in a different world in many ways than that which Jack Johnson lived in, when things were much more, there was much less sympathy for someone like Jack Johnson at the time. I think historically there is, but at the time, he left the country for quite a long time. He was, you know, pilloried in the white press and so on.
Even a number of black people were not sympathetic to Jack Johnson at the time. Different world entirely. Wanted to make sure I weaved in a few of our folks who dialed in with questions as well. Let's see, person who dialed in.
That's a good point. I mean, that's always been true. That's been true of a lot of groups. Especially, groups tend not to be monolithic. There's always within, as we know that about. You know, the 19th century America, the black leadership, there was strain there. And, you know, between Booker T. Washington and Du Bois and people like Monroe Trotter up in Boston, you know, you had a whole range of people who were somewhat more radical, some were much more accommodating, and so on and so on. And that's always been true, I think, not just among African Americans, but in any group of people who identify as a group and have a struggle, there's always a difference of opinion about how much to be accommodating, how much to be resistant, how much to speak out, and so on and so on. So you're right. And maybe some people thought Jack Johnson was, you know, that often happens, you know, Ida B. Wells got that a little bit too, even. You know, people said, hey, you're going to, you know, slow down. You're making too much ruckus, you know, and so on. And she'd always dismiss that and say, what are you, we have to speak clearly. We can't abide by this, and so on. So, you know, there's always that push and pull, I think.
Absolutely. Carter G. Woodson Booker T. Washington. There were so many reminders in this book. I had totally forgotten about when Booker T. Washington was beaten hanging out outside the apartment building, because we had talked about that some years ago. And I was just like, wow, there's so many of these. The mob spirit is, whew, man. Let's see, the caller who dialed in from a block number. If you have a question for Professor Dre, you should be with us. Might be in Toronto. Let's see.
Hi. Yes, it is. Hi, Gus, and hi, guest. And greetings, callers and listeners. So, yes, I did have a couple of quick questions. The first question is, in David R. Roediger's book, Working Towards Whiteness, he describes that those who were white, and meaning those from France, England, the Netherlands, Germany, and Scandinavian countries, taught new immigrants who were from Europe but classified as non-white, which were Greeks, Italians, Polish, Hungarian, Slavs, Irish, and other Europeans, that the new immigrants were shown how, by watching whites, how to become white, and the process of becoming white was in particular by abusing black people, and that included lynching. And the longer the generational abuse, which was two generations, then the closer the new immigrants would be to attaining white status. So going back to your comment where you said that white fear being replaced, is that really the case? Or is it merely whites upholding their contract to whiteness under the system of white supremacy? So that's the first question. And then the second question is, unity at what cost? You do classify yourself as white, correct?
Yes.
So this is, instead of they, this is part of your collective that was represented in the sedition at the Capitol. So the reason why I'm asking unity at what cost, considering the historical patterns of your collective being very dangerous, then and going unchecked, how are victims of racism, white supremacy to be safe by being forced to unify with such a dangerous people? Thank you, and I leave the line.
Okay. The first question, I'm not quite sure I was familiar with that theory of the way in which white immigrants, I mean, that's an interesting period in American history, of course, because what the listener was referring to is a period when there were immigrants who were themselves not considered white. They were considered something other, the Italians, the Irish, Eastern European Jews, people who arrived here in the end of the 19th century or beginning or middle of the 19th century. But I do think that it's always important to distinguish between African Americans and other minority groups. I do think that African Americans have a singular history and legacy. And it's a mistake, I think, to confuse them with other groups, whether they're Asians, Italians, Irish, who also had their own struggles. But I do think what African-Americans experienced was unique and singular. The other thing is, I think it's important to remember.
Sorry to interrupt, but that was not the question. I will repeat the question. In David R. Roediger's book, Working Towards Whiteness, he had advised in his book that those who were white, and that were people from France, England, the Netherlands, Germany, and Scandinavian countries, had taught new immigrants, Europeans who were non-white, who were Greeks.
I'm just trying to reiterate
the question because you were going off in a tangent and not answering. Can I please finish the question so I can get
No, because you're saying something that doesn't, they didn't teach.
Thank you very much. That will be all.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Did you want to get the second question?
I don't remember. I mean, I didn't mean to be rude to this caller, but this idea that a group of white people taught other new arriving white people to, I don't know if I really follow that line of reasoning. For one thing,
that was established from David R. Roediger's book called Working Towards Whiteness, who was also self-identified as a white man.
Well, okay, so have him call then. I don't know. I'm not reading it in context. I don't know. I don't know if I really agree with that. I mean, the white immigrant groups, for instance, the Irish Americans often did have their own, they had their own issues with African Americans. They were competitors for some of the same kind of employment. And so you did see that in the mid-19th century in America. You saw a certain tension between those two communities. And I don't know if it had to do with any. I don't think that no one was being taught anything by anybody else. I think it was an organic process that, you know, had its tensions. It resolved itself here and there in time. I mean, of course, as we know, all these groups eventually, you know, it's hard for us today to think, you know, Italian Americans, Irish Americans, German Americans, whoever. We tend to forget that in their time, they were all isolated and despised and so on. But again, as I said before, they did not have the singular experience of enslavement that the African American community did have. And I think that's a difference. Maybe we should move on to the next.
Again, sir, you're not answering the question. And I think you're practicing white supremacy right now. Thank you.
I didn't accept the premise of your question. I don't think this idea of whites teaching other newly arrived white people what to do or think. I don't know what you're quoting. I'm just saying I don't agree with the premise. Why don't we move on to the next caller, sir?
Caller 9029. Did you have a question for Professor Dre?
Greetings, callers and listeners. Greetings, Professor Dre.
Hi.
My first question for you is, hi. Is there any evidence of white people stopping the practice of racism, white supremacy against non-white people?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's always been this. I mean, even in the worst of times of, say, what you might call the lynching epidemic in America in the late 19th century, particularly in the South, there were always some people who would fight against it. Unfortunately, they were in the minority. And they themselves were often threatened or chased away or what have you. You know, it's a sad commentary, but in almost every lynching, there's one or two decent white people. Maybe it's a judge or a sheriff or a minister or whoever who is trying to stop it and say no. And they're fighting against it. Or as I mentioned before, someone like Abraham Lincoln who lectured about it. So, no, of course, there have been. And, of course, you know, closer to our time, of course, you saw in the Civil Rights Movement. The Civil Rights Movement was a black-led movement, but it had a lot of white allies who were participants and supporters. Some of them put their lives on the line, as we know, with Selma and Mississippi and so on. So, no, there always has been, you know, the NAACP, especially in its early years, was a biracial organization. The idea of the NAACP initially was to reactivate the spirit of the abolition movement from the early 19th century, which also had people of both races. I mean, this has always been the problem. You know, this has always been the question in our country is how are we going to solve this issue? And how are white people and black people going to figure out a way to do this? It hasn't always been a prominent question that people have acted on, but then again, it has. At certain times. And so, yes, there has been efforts made in this regard. You know, again, so, not always so, successfully.
Yeah, so that you made a good point, and this leads to my second question, because this is something that you basically are saying, is that usually the majority of white people that are fighting against racism are a small minority, and it's still prevalent, I believe, till this day. That being said, what can we as non-white people do to counter racism? What do you think we should do in regards to that to help the situation ourselves?
By ourselves, you mean non-white people or white people?
Yes, I mean black people. Yes, black people and other non-white people.
Well, it's just, I mean, again, it's just all you can do is kind of, I mean, look at what happens this past, what has gone on this past summer. I mean, it's the largest social movement in American history. Obviously, that is something, I don't know how you yourself or what, I mean, each person needs to decide what they can do, what they choose to do. Some people go march in the street. Some people go to law school and decide to fight through the law, become civil rights attorneys. Others just send a donation to an organization. In other words, everybody can be active in some way or another. And I do think that's, I mean, again, it's kind of a personal thing. Anybody needs to make that decision. What am I going to do? So, of course, you see efforts around us all the time, whether it's in Congress, Raphael Warnock, people, you know, in the Black Lives Matter movement, all, you know, Jamie Harrison, who ran against Lindsey Graham down in South Carolina. I mean, you see people putting themselves out in major ways, trying to address these issues. And of course, writers, scholars, filmmakers, it goes on in every front. Who among us hasn't been moved by a book by Toni Morrison or Claudia Rankine, someone like that? Am I sort of getting it? Okay. Does that kind of answer your question? I mean, yeah. It's like all, you know, we move on all fronts, basically.
I have a difference of opinion on it, but I think that's, you know, that's your honest answer. I appreciate it. I appreciate you being honest.
Much obliged. Before I get to our next caller, just based on his question that he asked, this speaking of people and subjects that we've covered on the program before, you were talking about white people who have given the appearance that they were working against racism, white supremacy. Can you tell us about one such person, Tom Watson, down in Georgia?
Well, he's a terrible example, Tom Watson. He's like, you know, they should be taking his statue down, that guy. You know, Tom Watson was some, I can just tell you what I remember about him is he was a populist. At one point, he was tried to ally himself with the African community and African American workers in Georgia, where he was from. He was later the governor of Georgia, I believe. And he also ran a newspaper, but he became a very virulent racist and also an anti-Semite. And really was, you know, you've heard of the Leo Frank case, which was a lynching of a white Jewish man in Atlanta, in Georgia, around 1915, I believe. And, you know, Tom Watson was the one, he was sort of like the Rupert Murdoch of his day down there. He was drumming up all this anti-Semitism and fervor about this, you know, Jew who'd gotten away with, you know, he was accused of murdering a young white girl. It doesn't appear he was guilty. He was innocent, but that didn't matter really. But he also was a racist and, he'd claimed that, of course, that his black allies had turned on him or something like that. But he was quite a piece of work, actually. So he's not a good example of some white man who, you know, I mean, white people who would you think of? I mean, who's been.
Let's try a second one. How about Joel Spingarn? And before I give your response, because he's another prominent white person featured in your book, this is in the LA Times. I want to preface because this is not, you know, some radical, you know, publication or what have you. This LA Times, they're reporting. I read it again, like, wow, I'm so glad I found this. Reading more important than watching television. When the state is terrified, citizens beware. A Memphis reporter writing about Dr. King uncovers decades of army spying on Americans. Before I give this little segment, you're familiar with COINTELPRO, Professor Dre, yes?
Somewhat. Okay. Somewhat, yes.
Okay. By the early 1920s, the Army had a spy network across the South. It included Robert R. Moton, Booker T. Washington's successor at the Tuskegee Institute, and no less a notable than Joel Springern, white board chairman of the NAACP. Van Diemen made Springern a major in military intelligence, and the latter, a man still much honored by the NAACP, helped operate a small unit of undercover agents. Van Diemen considered the NAACP to be communist-inspired, there's that word again, with the upsurges of the 1960s, the Army Intelligence Domestic Network cranked into high gear. By 1963, Tompkins reports U-2 planes were photographing disturbances in Birmingham, Alabama, capping a multi-layered spy system that by 1968 included 304 intelligence offices around the country, subversive national security dossiers on 80,731 Americans, plus 19 million personal dossiers lodged at the Defense Department's Central Index of Investigations. So that, to go back to one of your, we'll pick a different white. Let's see if we can do better than Tom Watson, Joel Springern.
Right. I mean, I don't know much about him personally, but if you say he was one of the white early leaders of the NAACP, I mean, let me say this about white allies of the African-American cause or the movement. I mean, obviously they have the privilege of turning away if they want, even temporarily, momentarily, whatever, what have you. They're not living that. They contribute mightily. I might mention someone like, say, William Lloyd Garrison, who was, you know, one of the leaders of the abolition movement, and many people gave him a lot of tribute for what he accomplished. And he himself was physically threatened and harmed many times, and so on and so on. You know, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney. Goodman and Schwerner were white New Yorkers who went to Mississippi in the 60s and were murdered by the Klan and the police. But nonetheless, the white allies, they're always, of course, because of their race, they have a certain, they're close, but they're not, they're involved, but they're not the same. They're not risking the same things compared to someone like John Lewis, who was also in Mississippi at that time. He brought a completely different profile, obviously. And so that's always been, and there has been tensions. It's not to say, you know, it's not always a walk in the park. You know, whites and blacks in the modern civil rights movement often found themselves at odds because the stakes were different for each in a certain way. And they brought a whole different culture and different viewpoint to it. They agreed on many, many things, and they took a lot of the same risks. You have all seen, you see pictures of Dr. King marching arm in arm with white supporters and so on. I mean, there were those people, and they were very courageous. But there's always, of course, it's always a difference. And that's one of the challenges, I think, that we still face, is how do we build that allyship with people who come from different advantages, different opportunities, different backgrounds, and so on. And that's always been there. So, yeah, I mean, someone like Joel Springern, again, I hesitate to talk about him. I don't know his life details that specifically. But there have always been, since we go back to even the late 18th century with the, Alexander Hamilton, the Manumission Society, with John Jay. Benjamin Franklin was an early abolitionist before his death in the late 18th century. So it goes way back in terms of white allies being involved. But of course, again, they're on the other side of the color line, basically. So it's always you know, it's a just a much different perspective is brought.
Hmm. Before we nab our next caller, just to make sure I get in, listeners should know, being a so-called abolitionist opposing slavery does not mean that you oppose racism, white supremacy. Two, I just wanted to read a quick paragraph from Professor Dre's book. This is in chapter, let me make sure I'm giving out the correct chapter, 5. The NAACP had discovered the problem within a problem that has historically plagued integrated activism in America. I am sick at heart over it. Mary Ovington confided about the tension between Villard and Du Bois. It means a confession to the world that we cannot work with colored people unless they are our subordinates. She worried that when we demand that some colored man be put in office, we shall be told, you can't give a nigger a big job. Haven't you found it out yourselves? She ends with a question rhetorically being asked, but this problem pops up in the book repeatedly, where people kind of talk about this tension working with white people to solve this problem. Red in Ohio, did you have a question for Professor Drake? Professor Dre. Red in Ohio, you should be with us.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Hello, Professor Dre.
The questions I have,
I'll just narrow it to two. So you have made mention when Gus was speaking about the role that white women played during the lynching spectacles, about them not necessarily being held accountable for their actions. You had basically said that white women, I guess in the context of like white men putting white women on a pedestal and saying that they were pure, is that because they are the ones that carry on the white race through birthing and nurturing white children, or what would be the reason for white men to proclaim or act as if white women are pure? But then if you, I guess, also go back in history, studying like feminism, what have you, white women also would claim that they were beaten and subjugated also by white men. So how does that kind of work out in your opinion?
That's a very interesting question, actually, because I think that they were, when I said they were on a pedestal, I meant that I think they were, it came out of the long history of the subjugation of black women by white men in the days of enslavement. I believe that the idea of this kind of a sense of white male guilt toward white women as sort of a compensation, white women were then placed above, kind of almost like this, and they were like angels or something. And you're right, maybe it was because also they were considered, you know, carrying on the purity of the white race or something. Of course, as we know, there were a lot of children born to also, you know, mixed relationships in the South as well. But the other thing your question touches on, which is interesting, is that white women were themselves, of course, subjugated to the kind of white patriarchy. And that was another one of the tensions that actually kind of helped trigger the lynching phenomenon, I think, which is that white women themselves were leaving the home. In other words, you get toward the end of the 19th century, white women were no longer satisfied to just sit. They didn't want to be like domestic angels anymore. They wanted to work and get out. They wanted to earn money. They wanted to teach, work in textile mills, say, in the South. Move to a city, et cetera. In other words, leave the home. And this also was a destabilizing factor which threatened the white patriarchy. And that, too, I think, fed into this idea that, well, these white women, they're newly mobile, they're going to, you know, they're then thus more vulnerable to, you know, the sexual advances of black men and so on. And it kind of triggered this kind of hysteria, this reaction to the kind of sexuality of not just black men, but white women themselves. And so, now you kind of touched on that a little bit. I think the growing independence of white women, they were stepping off their pedestal. They wanted to go to work. They wanted to be independent. Like, you know, it was the birth of the modern era. So that's a very interesting phenomenon. And I think there definitely was something to that. And what was your second question, Miss?
Thank you for answering that one. And then the last one, I know you had made mention about, I guess when you were speaking about allies prior to one of the callers asking the question, and you had said decent white people, and then an example was Abraham Lincoln. I won't give my own opinion about that, but mm-hmm. what would you just briefly classify, or what would qualify a white person to be quote unquote decent? And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Sure. I mean, I was saying a decent white person would be someone who had a respect for the law and a respect for other people, and had a certain respect for morality, and would see something like violence against, say, a black man who was being denied due process and rushed to judgment in a lynching, they would perceive that as being wrong, morally wrong, in addition to being against the law. So, yes, whether they're, I mean, again, decency is something you can, how do you put a value on that, perhaps, but at least in that context, they were doing the right thing. They were trying to stop a lynching. They were often saying, please stop this. We have laws to deal with crime. We don't do this. In that context, they were acting, they were being, trying to be good citizens, basically. Whether or not they personally, I mean, as Gus alluded to before, you never really know what a person privately thinks. Maybe they didn't have, they might not have, maybe they thought that, you know, they wouldn't hire an African-American to work for them. But they believe that this person does, they had the right to their life, and they did not deserve what the treatment they were receiving at the hands of a mob, and so on. So in that context, they were defending something. They were defending something, you know, part of the society recognized its structures and laws and institutions and so on. And again, a moral duty as well. So, I mean, I think that's what I meant by that. That's what we can, you know, however you want to characterize people who, you know, in a certain context do good things or try to protect the sanctity of life and liberty and so on. I think you will find people of all shades and colors acting in that way from time to time.
Much obliged, Red.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Red, in Ohio. Before we get Thomas in New York, so we are reading Red in Ohio. I think Thomas in New York, many of us, we are reading O.J. Simpson. So you talk about the Emmett Till case in your book, Example of Lynching, or Is It Lynching, quote unquote, even definition and all that good stuff. Mr. Jeffrey Toobin, in his book, The Run of His Life, his epilogue, he compares what happened in the O.J. Simpson trial to the Emmett Till trial, which I found fascinating. This is what he says. He says, for better or worse, American jurors have a long and still flourishing tradition of both taking race into account in making their decisions and denying that they are doing any such thing. The 10 whites, one Asian, and one Latino in Simi Valley, who in 1992 acquitted the LAPD officers in the Rodney King case, denied that race factored into their decisions. So did the 10 black and two white jurors who in 1990 acquitted Washington Mayor Marion Barry of all but one of the 14 narcotics charges against him. In 1955, the two white men charged with murdering Emmett Till were acquitted by an all-white Mississippi jury after about an hour of deliberations. A spokesman for the jurors attributed their decision to the belief that there had been no identification of the dead body as that of Emmett Till. What do you make of comparing the Emmett Till jurors' decision to the O.J. Simpson jury decision, where that jury was, for O.J. Simpson, 9 black jurors, 1 non-white, non-black juror, so-called Latino, and then 2 white women?
I don't know. That's a tough one. I mean, the one thing that I remember about the O.J. case, and you guys are reading a book about it, so you know this better than I do, but, you know, that was one of the first times that the idea of critical race theory was mentioned. Of course, that's become a more common term in recent years. But I remember at the time of the O.J. verdict, there were articles written about, well, there's this thing they call critical race theory, which is that black people see the world differently than white people do. They have different expectations and different perspectives. And that's what guided the black jurors to acquit O.J. And that's why white people didn't understand it. White people were like, well, what are you saying? He's innocent? That doesn't make any sense. But, of course, that's what it was. And there was the idea that African-Americans viewed the same, that we could be looking at the same incident, the same characters and so on, and see it differently. And that really played a role, I think, in the O.J. case. In terms of the Emmett Till trial, I mean, there, I don't know what you, it's sort of, I mean, in a way, the only kind of similarity there is that the world on it was spun in the white Mississippi courtroom, spun so completely in the opposite direction that there was probably no way those men would have been convicted. In other words, as you point out, the juror, the fact that even they wasted an hour, I mean, you think they could have done it in probably 10 minutes. I mean, they were not going to convict those guys because of the culture of small town. This was like Tallahatchie County, Mississippi, I think, in the mid-1950s. And if you know the story of the case and such, it was very unlikely that those men were going to be convicted. Of course, it's interesting. One comment I'll make is that, in a way, they've been convicted by history, partly through the actions of Emmett Till's mother, who, you know, this is an infamous thing or famous thing, is that, you know, she insisted that her son's coffin be open at the funeral. And a photograph was taken of Emmett Till and how his horrifically mutilated face, which appeared in Jet magazine. And that's an iconic image that many of us know. It's a horrifying image. And she insisted that it be so that the whole world could see what had happened to her son. So in a certain way, yes, those white men were acquitted, but they were convicted, really. And she made sure that they were. And that, in a way, that's the legacy of that case to this very day, I think.
They bragged. I'm sorry. They bragged about the killing and got paid, as you write about in the book, they got paid handsomely to brag about the killing after the trial was over. So,
Right. They told their story for Look magazine, I think.
Right.
Yes.
Let's see. Thomas in New York. Thank you for your patience, sir. Do you have a question for Professor Dre?
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the guests.
Hello.
Hello, sir. I have three questions here, if I can get them in. Obviously, you blame Trump for the Capitol raid. And my question is, what about the riots that occurred all summer that were cheerleaded by the liberal politicians and the same media that's calling these people terrorists? Should they be held accountable? And just for more context, the current vice president collected money to get some of the protesters some of whom attacked police and looted businesses bailed out of jail. Why do you think there's such a double standard when these two things are discussed?
You're referring to the Black Lives Matter protests of the past summer and the Capitol insurrection of a couple of weeks ago. As I understand your question, in other words, you're saying, it's an interesting question. First of all, I was never clear in the Black Lives Matter protests. It wasn't never clear to me exactly. I always had the sense that those protests were largely peaceful, but there were violent sort of agents provocateur in those crowds. And sometimes even, say, in Minneapolis, which is my hometown, they even had video of a man setting fires who was later identified as not one of the Black Lives Matter protesters, but rather a kind of infiltrator from some sort of white supremacist group or something. So I was never entirely clear on how much of that really was emanating from the Black Lives events. I only went to one Black Lives Matter March. It was entirely peaceful. There were thousands of people there. I didn't see any kind of, there was no occupying of a building, fighting with the police, anything of that nature. So whereas we know what happened to the Capitol, we all have seen that. There was no, yes, of course, many people stayed out of the building and probably just went home or back to their hotel. But some people did, you know, defy the law and go into the building and so on. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, the charges that you're making about Kamala Harris, I'm unfamiliar with that. You're saying she bailed people out of Black Lives Matter protesters who'd been arrested?
She collected money for an organization that bailed people out.
She was part of an organization. I mean, again, they may have been. She helped collect some money for it. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of, as you know, in the after the what happened at the Capitol, there was a lot of criticism that those protesters were treated with kid gloves compared to a lot of the Black Lives Matter protesters. So, again, if we're talking about Black Lives Matter protesters who were peaceful but who were arrested nonetheless, that's sort of a different – if they were arrested for civil disobedience, like standing in a road or something like that – that's different than an insurrectionary crowd that is attempting to violate the Congress of the United States and basically stop it or hurt its members, or in case of Mike Pence, hang him, I guess, or whatever they wanted to do. So that's a slightly different story. So that's what I mean. I don't know how much of an equivalence is there, really. It's very popular on the right to make it sound like Antifa is – sort of equate Antifa with the Proud Boys and so on. I just don't know if I follow that somehow. I'm sorry. I don't know enough about it. I'm not sure I see the parallel exactly somehow. I mean, I know we're going to hear a lot of that equivalence. You said you had a couple of different questions, okay. Sir.
Talked about hands of people unknown or persons unknown.
Yes.
Sounds like that term has been refined, and I just want to know your thoughts on this. In modern times, when it comes down to murders of black people as gang-related or just simply drug-related, and it's no investigation, it's no further, no prosecution, do you think that's similar?
You're talking about, in other words, you're talking about black on black shootings and crime. You're saying in like drug related, gang related.
Not in the relation of black on black, but the fact that there's a dead black person and no one's going to look to see who tried to solve the murder, who killed.
I see. No, I mean, of course, that's not exactly. Obviously, that's not good either. It doesn't refer to that specific phrase. Death at the hands of persons unknown was, again, that was the law coming along after a lynching, which was an unlawful event, and trying to assign a kind of legal conclusion to it by saying we basically don't – not only don't we – it's not that we don't know who did it, because, of course, they always knew who had done it, but rather we don't want to know, and we don't want to announce or proclaim who did it. So the motives might be slightly different. I'm not as familiar with the follow-up on gang shootings. In other words, you're saying that these murders go uninvested. The police don't bother to investigate them, and the prosecutors don't charge anybody.
Yeah, the law comes along and they already say they don't care. You know, that's pretty much the point I was getting at. My very last question.
Okay.
Now, I disagree with your notion that white men have a fear of being replaced, or white people, and that's one of the reasons that we have white supremacy. The U.S. government created the one-drop rule and anti-miscegenation laws all around the country. It seems like white people's fear is genetic survival. Now, just to get further, and I just want to know your thoughts on this, I think the fear that you're talking about of being replaced plays out when you talk about other white ethnics, like the, you know, Irish, the Catholic, you know, whoever came over, they suffered harsh treatment and were alienated, but they were not lynched and mistreated for centuries like black people. And in fact, some of those white ethnics lynched black people. You could look at the draft riots in 1863 here in New York.
Some of those people
just got off a boat a week ago. So I just wanted to know, why would you say that? It seems like the genetic annihilation part is more important, the fact that we can't mix.
Right. Well, that's interesting. You're asking a couple of different things. It's interesting about what you're saying about the Irish Americans and the draft riots. We touched on that a little bit earlier. Yes, that's absolutely right. In other words, there was, in that particular sense, what it was that a lot of the Irish Americans were very much represented in the Union Army, and they were called upon to serve. They were drafted, and they felt that they were fighting what they called the Negroes' War, in other words. And that was part of the hostility they had toward African Americans, was they felt that they were risking their lives for African Americans. In terms of the thing about the one drop rule and the genetic, I don't know how you want to. I didn't think of it so much in terms of a genetic replacement as just more of a demographic one. In other words, I think that's what we're already seeing that in America. In other words, the Hispanic community is growing. We know that just looking at demographics, that within the next 20 or 30 years, America will be, whites will no longer be a majority. There'll be what they call a majority-minority of many different groups having equal or closer to equal shares of the demographics of the country. However, the genetics are involved. Those are always, to me, those always seem more and more vague all the time. In other words, just because someone identifies as white, we don't know genetically or whoever they may be. I see this all the time in New York, especially if you live in New York, it sounds like as well. Just walking around the street or on the subway, you see people of so many different shades of, you know, it's a very polyglot population. But just in terms of how people are identified, I think that there is a certain, that's what I think it is, partly a sense of being replaced, losing a kind of sense of white domination, I think, and a fear of these changes, a fear of the future, basically, is what it is, of a different kind of racial future that is on the horizon, which it just, there's no, it's coming. There isn't, I don't know what can be done about it or why it's perceived as harmful necessarily. It's always been sort of the history of our country, basically. I mean, you can take the arguments against Muslims or whoever it is today and go back 150 years ago, and it's almost literally the exact same words were being used against the newly arrived Irish and Italians and Eastern European Jews and so on. So it's a kind of hysteria that has just, it's always been there with us, and we see it again today.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Let's see. Retired firefighter in Florida. Did you have a question for Professor Dre? You should be with us.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the guests.
Hey.
To the guests, I'm going to challenge you. Earlier in the program, you described the Peekskill riots as a quote-unquote dark day. I recall watching a report on that incident on YouTube, and it appeared to be daylight. And also, as far as the participants in this riot, it appears to be that most of the people were racially classified as white. Could you explain your reasoning on why you made that description?
Yeah, I mean, that's just, I just meant it was a you know, a dark chapter in our history. It was, yes, it was a sunlit day, and the antagonists were white. They were, of course, the people who were being victimized were also, many of them were white as well, like Howard Fast, as Gus read that portion earlier. But it was a very, just a very unfortunate day. It was ugly. It didn't end until nighttime, really, when these buses straggled back into Manhattan with a lot of, you know, bleeding victims and all. So, yeah, I think that's what I meant.
So would it be more correct to say it was a white day?
Well,
that's a question.
No, because, well, it depends. You're picking up on the idea of the dark. Dark as being an offensive term of some kind. Dark day is a term.
Most times it is, correct?
A dark day, whenever you, what isn't, I mean, you're.
Well,
you're,
I mean, I there, think, there's dark day, dark complexion, dark ages. Most times I hear the term dark is associated with something negative. And I was just asking you, you know, on why you use the term. You are a writer, a professional writer, and I think I would consider you to be an expert on words.
Okay, let's go to the next question.
Uh-huh, okay. The next question is probably also challenging, I would guess. You also stated about that white people are considering that there are basically are conscious of the idea that they're going to be something that you identified as the minority. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. There's a lot of places around the world where white people are the majority, such as South Africa. And the system of racism, white supremacy is still here. So could you explain on why you think white people would be kind of like nervous or something because they are a quote unquote minority in a place?
Well, it's for all the obvious reasons, because they lose, they're afraid. Of course, they will still be the largest group of people in America, but they won't, there will be other, the minorities will constitute a majority of the population. In other words, the whites will have diminished demographically. So they'll just, by definition, they'll have less political sway. I mean, where do you think all the voter suppression comes from? It's because the whites want to retain, they don't want as many people of color voting. So that's, in other words, that's an example of it. It's this eagerness to cling to the white dominance, the demographic dominance. How it works, why it bothers people, that's like a psychological question in a way, and I don't agree with it. I don't know. I wish it wasn't there, but I do think that is what motivates a lot of this resistance.
Do you think the global system of white supremacy will still exist, including in this part of the world that you state that there is some concern about?
It's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think they fear that it, I mean, whether, I don't know what they think, but I mean, I think that is their fear.
Who is they? Excuse me, sir. I'm sorry to interrupt, but who is they?
That's right. I'm talking about the white population, the whites that are reacting to what they fear is the demographic changes in America. In other words, the growth of minority populations, both physically and also just in the power they have. Whether it's the voting, it being able to elect people, and so on and so on, it's that fear of a diminishment of white dominance, I think, that is at the heart of a lot of the tension that we see coming from, whether it's the birther movement, whatever in the last several years. I mean, that's not an original thought for me. That's very much commented on. And they themselves will say that.
Well, you happen to be the only white person in on the line right now. I would assume so. That's why you were asked the question.
I didn't ask the question. I'm telling you that's what I think.
I asked the question. It's because you're the only white person on the line.
Oh, I see. Well, you can ask an African American person might give you the same answer. I mean, it seems very clear that that's what it is. That's, again, where the resistance is from that group of people, the whites who want to cling to that.
I think it's more accurate to ask a white person than a non-white person.
Did you have another question, firefighter?
No, sir.
All right, Gus. Listen, I think I'm sort of tired of talking. I think I'm going to leave you. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Can we get one of our other callers in really quick before you go? They called in from the LA area, I think. Can we nab our last caller before you go?
Okay, just one question though.
Let's see. Our California caller, do you have a question for Professor Drake?
Yeah, thanks for allowing me to ask the question, Gus and Professor Drake. Given your book, Professor, do you think it would make sense and be logical for non-white people to be suspicious of all white people while we live in a system of white supremacy?
To be suspicious of them? I wouldn't, if somebody said they were, I wouldn't say they were wrong. I mean, you couldn't be, that's a kind of subjective motive on someone's part. If you want to be suspicious, you'll be suspicious.
Suspicious of them for the being a racist. I should have probably clarified.
Right. I don't know what to say to that. I mean, I wouldn't blame somebody if they were. It could hinder you. I mean, it could make life difficult in a certain way. I mean, to go around being suspicious of people. But I can see it. I don't really know how to answer that.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Much obliged. We've been chatting
okay,
up.
Okay, Gus.
Philip Dre, the author of
Thanks
At
for
the Hands of Persons Unknown. Thanks for hanging out, sharing a bit of your Tuesday evening with us. Was a hoot to chat, sir. We will be here for the book club on Thursday. O.J. Simpson stole a little bit of O.J. time today, but we'll be here for Thursday. O.J. Simpson, Mark Furman actually coming to the witness stand. Looking forward. Anywho, our broadcast for today, I hope folks can see some of the consistencies in terms of it should not be any sort of surprise, mob, antics, group behavior, long history that is not anything that just started a couple days ago. It didn't just start in 2020 because they were upset about masks. It didn't just start in 2009 when President Obama was elected. This is long running white conduct in particularly white mob terrorism and violence. Long running in the system of white supremacy. Lots of examples. And in all everything that we saw in the Capitol, police either, we're not going to get involved to stop it, and or we're going to hop in and participate in some hooligan terroristic behavior ourselves. National Guard, same thing. Military personnel, same thing. Elected officials, same thing. White women, white children, lots of the exact same antics, long history of this behavior. One other thing I'll say, or at least this is a recommendation that I give out, victims guaranteed qualified, bravo for folks getting their question in. I recommend not making statements. If it's time to ask white people questions, there's no need to give a whole lot of statements. There's no need to even explain why I'm asking the question sometimes. I'm just asking questions to get information. We're just trying to get information, just trying to ask questions and get better about asking those questions. Not making statements or explaining why I asked the question to a white person. I'm really a fan of high ratio of questions. Question, 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 question. Not a lot of statements and what have you. And when I get to the phone lines, one of the reasons I say that is because generally there are other victims of racism who also want to ask a question. So the goal is not, let me see if I can get in other statements and do things that might, we're not going to get to other folks to get questions in. That's not the goal. It's just we're trying to be as efficient as possible so we can maximize, get as many opportunities for other victims of racism to ask a question. Very important to be mindful of that, I think, or at least that's something I try to be mindful of. Maximize the opportunity for victims of racism to ask questions of white people. That's it. We'll be here Thursday. OJ Simpson. I'm so looking forward to the book club. Let's see. Anything else I wanted to get in from what we shared today? I always love it. I love it when I'm able to read the book that a white person wrote, because I feel like they have a really easy time, right? If you quote a different source, you're like, oh, I don't know what that is, right? See how they do that? I think B asked the question, she was reading a different white author, and like, oh, I don't know who that is, right? They'll do that sort of thing. I don't know who that is, and I can't vouch for what they say, even if it's a non-white author. They say, oh, I don't know who that is. I've never heard that before. I can't, comment or talk about that. But I love it being prepped and being able to respond. When the question came up about white allies, well-meaning white people, and working with them, there are a number of those folks mentioned right here in the book. And to just be able to go down and drop names. What about Tom Watson? Isn't he a well-meaning white person? And he said, oh, that's not a good example. That's one of the best examples. Joel Springer. Oh, that fella is mentioned 9 times in the book. Matter of fact, I went back to check. It's not a biography of Joel Springer. Not at all, but he is mentioned like repeatedly in the text. That's the white fellow who was affiliated with the military and a part of their spy operation in the South. That's the sort of thing. I love it. This is what you wrote. So if we're going to talk about well-meaning white people, there are a number of well-meaning white people in your book that still seem like they are rather dangerous, rather dastardly, practicing racism, white supremacy. Even the quote, can't trust the Negro with a big job. Some of the NAACP white staff members love it, love it, love it, love it. But the main thing, the mobocratic spirit. Man, I thought of this book as soon as everything happened in the Capitol siege, as they call it. Lots of incident. This book even has some of the pictures, like I said, for folks who were with us. We read Gerald Horn's biography on Paul Robeson. I don't even remember pictures in that book. They did have some, but I don't remember pictures of teenage white girls threatening, terrorizing black and white people at Peekskill. I do not remember that. I'll have to go back and double check, but at minimum, just if you get a glance, if you go to the bookstore, go to the library, if it ever reopens or what have you, if you see this book, just look for some of the pictures that they have of the mob violence. In fact, the cover photo features white women at the bottom. Most of it is fictional. It has the body of a lynched black person, but white women at the forefront of the mob. Can't have a system of racism without their participation. All of that's it. Let's see. Folks who were with us, if you have comments you would like to share, what you heard, feel free. We'll share a bit before we wrap things up.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I apologize if I made that mistake. Can I be heard? I guess the line's been lost. Pretty sure connection's lost. I can hear you. I can't hear anybody else.
I'm still on the line, but I think it's disconnected. I think that's disconnected, perhaps.
or maybe another technical issue?
Yeah, I think Gus is just the only one lost.
Can you guys hear me?
Mm-hmm. I got disconnected. I'm back. Got connected. I'm back. Second time today.
I was going to say, Gus, I apologize as well. I was trying to get him to be specific, but he was practicing racism very good with his words. My question about the riots and the riots of the summer seems like, you know, you don't have a system of justice if everyone, certain group of white people are treated one way and a certain group of white people are treated another. You know, that's why I asked that. And the gang-related and drug-related shootings that I've experienced my whole life that don't get white people show up on the scene with their little tags of bullet shots and things all over the place, and they just say it's a drug-related shooting and no one gets arrested. It doesn't matter who the perpetrator was, the victim was a black man. And, I knew he was going to get into the white ethnic stuff. That's why I tried to beat him to the punch, because that's how New York white people, my people were the same as yours when they got off the boat. It's like, no, they weren't. You know, but it's definitely about genetic survival. I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Hi, Gus.
Be in Toronto.
Hi. I, too, also apologize. I was, when he interrupted the question, I was trying to reiterate it as he was clearly not answering. But I will do, work on condensing the question in future. One observable thing that I've noticed is that as the question comes towards the truth, he tends to run from it and wants to go to the next question. So that was, I thought, was very interesting. And he had a way of taking a question, changing the words around to answer his own question and not the original question. Thank you, and I leave the line.
Great observation. Be in Toronto, very common with a number of our white guests, something you have to be very mindful about. I guess you'd have to be precise when you put your question together and then make sure that they don't switch around when you go to get your response. If you ask a question, let's say you ask a question, it's something dealing with racism, and then they'll respond talking about bias or discrimination or white privilege. Lots of different ways. We probably got about 20 different examples of that during the broadcast this evening, but it is very... In fact, I thought he was going to do that with when I asked him my definition of white supremacy racism. He pivoted to what the definition used to mean. He pivoted to what the definition used to mean. And I was about to hop in and be like, wait a minute, I just want to know, do you think the definition is accurate? But then he came back around to it at the end. But always something to be mindful about. And again, it's always expect, be prepared for it. Not surprised about a white person practicing white supremacy racism. Like, no big, that's dogs bark, birds chirp. We got that. In a question setting context, it's really more just that, at least for me, I'm just trying to maximize the number of questions that we can get in from our listeners. So it's never a, you know, disgruntled about responses, what have you. I'm just trying to make sure we can get to as many of our listeners as possible and really just get as many questions in as possible. We, you know, can get a suspected racist white person on the broadcast. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments based on what you heard.
Heard
both of you.
Go ahead, sir. It's all right.
Jamarco's point, where she was talking about the idea that the foreign-born white person support white supremacy. I'm actually reading, trying to get caught up, being packing them in, and it stuck out to me. Washington packing them in. Drake operating as a mutual between black performers, foreign boards were not slow to adopt the prevailing stereotypes about niggas, foreign, how to cuss, help, and say nigga as soon as they get over there, the niggas. That would have been an interesting counterpoint to his thing that they weren't taught to support them and some vice friends.
Much obliged, sir. It was a little challenging. I'm not sure if you're on speaker. It was a little challenging to hear, but if I did understand correctly from the book Packing Them In, you're reading the section talking about how the so-called immigrants, these were newly arrived individuals who may not have been considered white at that time, how they were arrived, their disregard for black people, and how they ended up. He talks about some of that in the book. He's got some of the rioting that happened in Illinois, viciously attacking black people there. So some of that is exactly included in the book. There are lots of, I think that was Thomas in New York when he brought up the so-called draft riots, where he immediately like, oh yes, we're definitely not fighting for the Negros, even though we just stepped out, haven't even unpacked my laundry, but we are not for the Negros. Not ignorant about racism. Packing Them In, from the lots of books from the book club on display this evening. Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington, who was a guest on the Cows for Earth Day 2020. We read that book in the book club, and then we talked about it in depth with her about a year ago. Much obliged, sir. Let's see. With the other caller who spoke up simultaneously, do you have commentary?
Interesting. You hear him make these a lot of white people come on and make these comments that are constantly contradicting themselves. One of the things that I noticed is when he gave an answer to the first question of evidence of white people stopping the practice of racism, he said, yeah, throughout history, there've always been, you know, one or two in a crowd or, you know, and I'm sitting here listening to him talking about one or two people in a crowd. You know, and he says it himself that they are always the vast minority. They are always the minority. So I'm kind of confused. You know, I was confused immediately. How does that small minority to me, relate to call, you know, bringing some kind of justice or causing some kind of bringing some kind of equality about? Like, it just was confusing hearing that. And then right afterwards, I asked him, what do you feel that we as non-white people can do to counter racism? And he had nothing. Like, he just said, you know, it's on the people, it's on every individual. And there was nothing concrete that he would say or did say. Like, didn't say, oh, well, you know, you should focus on economics and take care of your health and change the dynamics of the so-called culture that you have been, that's been put upon you. Like, nothing. And that's what I found was, like, when I was listening to him, I was like, this guy is really trying to dodge as many questions as possible. And I'm almost glad. I felt bad for being Toronto because he was just flat out rude, you know, to me. That's just the way I saw it immediately when he said, nope, next question. You know, it just he didn't really seem like he was in the business of solving anything. Just make some money off of his book and keep moving. I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Was this guest the first time on the show?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
He was very good at, like what the caller just said, avoiding questions and brushing people's questions off, especially with V. I heard that, and I agree. I did think he was being pretty rude to her, and I didn't think her questions were that out of the line, but then again, I'm not a racist suspect, so I need my line.
David Rod, I bet he's heard of, like, David Roediger is, like, really well known. Like, I wouldn't exactly say he's Tim. Well, yeah, I guess you all could let us know if you've heard of him, but, like, if you study, like, critical race theory, whiteness studies, anything like that, you know David Roediger. Like, he's written a bunch of books. He's not some flaming radical. He's no Mumia Abu-Jamal or whoever else you want to, Dr. Kanban, whoever else you think is like some radical, you know, author or what have you, who, you know, can't be trusted. Like, he's respected. He gets invited to come and do talks and everything. I think he's a professor at a college. So I'm pretty sure that Professor Dre has heard of David Roediger's work before. And there have been, I mean, the books, there are piles of them. What is it? How the Irish Became White. Noel Ignatia, if he's been a guest on the program, how the Italians became white, how Jews became white. It's tons of these. We had Matthew Fry Jacobson, where he talks about this whole, that's what his whole book is about. These individuals who maybe they were not quite classified as white at the beginning of the 1900s. And then they come over, they learn what to do. Maybe they change their name. We talked about all that, to change your name around, so you get a white sounding name, put that in quotes, and then you learn some Negro jokes and you're on your way. Marry a white person, white male, white female, whatever it is, stay away from the Negroes, and boop, one generation or maybe sooner than that, you are good to go. Like, that is not, you know, radical theory. That is pretty commonly, you know, talked about, critical race theory and all of that, very well understood. Let's see. Other folks, comments they wanted to make sure they get in.
Also, I have a question for you. What was the name of that, the last white guest you had, talking about the O.J. Simpson book? And he was talking about the blood collection, and it had a chemical inside of it that would have discarded it as evidence. What was the name of that chemical?
You're not talking about EDTA, right?
That could have been his. You said EDTA?
Yes. I think that is going to come up in the book yet. I haven't read ahead. I only read a little bit ahead just so I could get
I got the impression, maybe I have to listen to the show again, that the guy who came on last week said that there was a chemical in the blood that would have proven that it was collected in a valve, and they didn't want to use that evidence in the court case.
Oh, yeah. EDTA. I am not a scientist, so I don't know what the abbreviation stands for, but it's EDTA, and it's a preservative. That's in certain test tubes that they use if they collect a sample of blood. And so that became a big point of contention later on in the trial, once they start getting to the witnesses and the DNA evidence in the case and what have you, that if there's any EDTA at all in the blood, that should raise serious question marks, because it wouldn't be there naturally. Like, if you just took a sample from someone, they would not have EDTA, certainly not in high concentrations in their bloodstream. So if that's happening here, then there is a problem, there's suspicion, there's a likelihood there's no likelihood. That would mean this blood did not come from a cut or what have you, or something of that nature. This blood came from a test tube preservative, EDTA. I'm not sure. I haven't read Tubin's book, so I don't know if he covers that. Some people who talk about the O.J. Simpson case, they don't discuss any of that. That none of that is in the television series and what have you. So I don't know. We'll have to see if Tubin covers any of that. But that is the chemical.
Can I be heard?
Read in Ohio.
I'll just mention something about Thomas from New York's question about the EDTA. It's an anticoagulant. So basically, like, when you put it in the test tube, I'm not a scientist or anything, it's just reading these books. And then the last one by, I think it was Stephen Singular or Singleton, the other white man, the journalist, he goes into a lot more detail about it than what Tubin does. So if you wanted more information about that, you may want to read his book. Even the audiobook is really, really short. Just a few comments. I'll try to make them really short, I guess, just to follow the same trend of everybody else, or most everybody else on the call. I also thought that he was definitely a suspected refined white supremacist. Just like everybody else was saying, he wasn't really answering questions. It kind of got annoying, but I was, you know, trying to teach myself this is, you know, this is how white people act, and just trying to apply that to like my regular life. If you notice this, if I notice this in a white person, whether at the job or wherever, if I'm out, then to be able to still have some couth and to not fly off at the cuff. But I noticed that, just like Gus said, didn't really answer the question originally about racism, but then Gus said he did go ahead and finally answer it. He also said, at first he wasn't really going to answer the question about OJ being guilty, but then he did finally say that he presumed he was guilty based on his actions after the murders, so not about any facts of the case. But he also said that he wasn't a student of the trial. I've never heard of anything like that. I've never heard that you had to be a student of the trial. Another thing that I noticed, and I'm going to try to make more of an effort to bring this up, but it seems like some of the white men, at least some of them recently, they act as if they don't remember anything about their book that they had supposedly written and researched. And I'm assuming it takes, from what I have learned about other books, it could take years to compile the research and then to actually write the book, then to get it revised and the editing and things like that. So for him to not really remember passages about the book, it was a little bit odd. Or even if he didn't remember them, you would think that he would just do like some type of, you know, brushing up, because he did agree to the interview. So I thought that that was just another way that he was practicing racism. And it almost made it seem like he was trying to separate himself from the passages in his book that Gus was reading, if they could be presumably seen as, I don't know, truthful. Because he was saying, one thing that I caught was that he said, well, to Gus, well, you alluded to when you were reading, as if Gus was reading somebody else's book. At least that's how I took it. And then I guess the last thing I'll mention, because there was a lot, even his response about the decent white people, and then him saying that Abraham Lincoln was a decent white person, that was ridiculous. The last thing I'll mention was his comments about the Emmett Till. There was actually two things. His comments about the Emmett Till trial, and he said, and I quote, "They were convicted by history." That doesn't even make sense. And I know he knows that that doesn't. I don't know, but. I've never heard of anything like that, convicted by history. And he said that when Mamie Till had put the photo or released the photo to Jet Magazine of Emmett Till's distorted body, they were also convicted by that. I'm like, this is not, these are like so supposed to be symbolic. And if you're a decent person, I don't know, or a decent white person, I don't know if he classifies himself as that. That goes against his whole definition of, you know, respectful of the law. And I won't go into his whole definition, but I wrote it down. The last thing is that he said that the jurors in the O.J. Simpson trial, he was alluding to something about critical race theory. And no, he did say that kind of helped people to understand that black people see the world differently. And I think that was how I took it, was his way of very covertly saying that they also did not pay attention to the evidence. All they felt was that this is another black male being railroaded, quote unquote, by the system. So I took that as really racist too. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged. Red in Ohio. I wholeheartedly agree. That was one. It's so hard. I'm so glad maybe this will give folks a glimpse It is generally substantially more challenging when I talk to white people for a lot of different reasons. That is one right there. Now, when we were talking about the O.J. Simpson thing, O.J. Simpson is like a brief, like one sentence in the book. His book is not about O.J. Simpson at all. So I generally, if I'm talking to anybody, a white person, non-white person, I generally don't try to stray off into wacky tangents and then be like, hey, I didn't, you know, agree to come talk about that. That's just a quick line in the book. Like, I'm, you know, I'm no student of the case, that type of thing. But when he said that her memory is correct, that's what he said. He said, because he was like, that showed us, that was when critical race theory came to be. I don't know if that's true or not. That's when critical race theory came to be. And it kind of showed us that black people see things in a totally different way than white people do. That we could be looking at the same thing, the same evidence, and see things in a totally different manner. I 1,000% agree with what Red in Ohio was just saying about, wait a minute, that, oh, because you hear that so often, white people suggesting that somehow either the black people didn't look at the evidence, they were too dumb to interpret the evidence, they were emotional, and or they just didn't see things the same way as white people. Do they have the same type of eyes, or, you know, they have different type of retinas, or what's going on? And it's totally ignoring three of the people on the jury were not black. What's their excuse? Did they become honorary black members for their time on the trial, so they have the same biological afflictions and they also could not see things in the same way as white people? All of that. Like, I was sitting there like, man, because we could totally go off on a tangent here and talk about that for 20 minutes, or we get back to what we're supposed to talk about. But, man, that, right? Even that, like what he said about, he said he did not pay attention to it, but he assumed he was guilty because he ran. And we even talked about that going into more detail on the book. Did he run or not? But what happened to presumption of innocence? Maybe even looking at the evidence. Like I said, I just assumed he was guilty because everybody else did. I'm a victim too. But I mean, dang, no evidence, no nothing. Just Renthal did it. Oh, well, moving on. Excited for Thursday. Cannot wait. OJ Day on the cows. Anywho, let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary on what he had to. Oh, I did want to say about the book as well. We have heard that Red's other observation, get so excited about OJ Simpson. This book was published in 2002, right? Anybody says, hey, I have a hard time remembering what I said last week, you know, or a month ago, much less 20 years ago. All of that said, as Red stated, many of these books take a long time to publish. Like Isabel Wilkerson, she said it took 15 years for her to research and publish The Warmth of Other Suns. Like this book, I don't think that this was like a 2-day project. I'm going to get it. Maybe I should have asked him that. How long did it take you to put this project together? But I don't think he just sat down over like 2 months and boom, at the hands of persons unknown. And regardless of how long it took to put together, he's been given, this was a Pulitzer Prize winning finalist. I am certain he has done a talk or 20 about this book over the years. So there would be some memory, what they call, they have a term, savings in learning. So even if I do forget, you know, a little bit, I don't remember, you know, every exact detail, I don't remember every exact date, every exact name. Once you mention something, like, oh yeah, Orlando Patterson, yeah, he was talking about consumption, boom, 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 boom. That's what I would expect. We've had that from tons of white people over the years, where they come on the program, we read a portion from the book, myself, or even sometimes listeners, and they act like they have never even heard this before. Like she said, the detachment from it, like, oh yeah, that author's passage is strike. Like, what do you mean that author you wrote? Like, we've had that tons over the years. I would definitely encourage folks to be mindful about that, especially some of the passages, like you were saying, that reveal truth, maybe a little less pussyfooting. Like, ooh. Yes, that author had some poignant things to say there. What a fascinating passage. Yes. Other folks who dialed in with commentary.
Excuse me, Gus.
Let's get firefighter, and then we'll get the caller.
Oh, I was going to ask because I didn't come on at the very beginning. Matter of fact, I missed your traditional meaning to a guest, especially a white guest. But my question came up because I heard him make the statement about the dark days. But that was reference. I mean, he was talking about the Paul Robeson riot. But did that have anything to do with the book that he wrote? The Paul Robeson incident?
Oh, yeah. His book is all about lynchings of black people and white mob violence. So that's just one of, billions of them in the book and beyond. The incident where Paul Robeson in Peekskill, New York, was attacked by mobs of white people.
Right, I'm aware of that one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, he did write about it. Okay.
Yes, sir. Yes, words are important. Great, I remember it. I did not say a word. But I certainly remembered when he said that it was a dark day. Mr. Fuller has that explicitly in the word guide about that sort of thing. Dark day, dark time.
Yes,
absolutely. Every time it is something vile and horrendous. And
that's why I put it in terms of a question, by stating, that it didn't appear that it was dark in the day. And the people, it didn't appear to be dark-complected people, quote-unquote. That's it.
Brilliant. Absolutely. Other male caller?
Yes, Gus. I was just inquiring. I remember, if I'm correct, critical race theory. Wasn't that brought up by Derrick Bell, if I'm correct? I think it was like a Harvard professor. You spoke about somebody else that was also an intricate part of it. I'm not aware of that individual, but I was just asking the question of who that individual was in reference to the critical race theory.
I think Derrick Bell is one of the folks who is credited as being the founder, if not one of the founders, the founder of that concept, critical race theory, as it's called. And yes, he was a professor at Harvard. I think he's passed away now, transitioned, the late Derrick Bell. But yes, I think he's one of the folks who is credited. And I think he even is talked about as being one of President Obama's mentors. I think they may have been up in the Harvard area at the same time when he was President Obama was doing his grad work and all the rest. But and he mentioned, Professor Dre mentioned that during his commentary about the O.J. Simpson trial, which I don't have like verification immediately, but I think that might be correct, that that term was becoming more popular and more widely used around the same time period, mid-90s. I think that might be correct. I'll have to go back and double check. But yes, Derrick Bell, I think he is one of the folks who is credited with that concept, among others.
Okay, thank you. I'll take a look into another one of his books. I have one book called Faces at the Bottom of the Well, but it doesn't deal with critical race theory. So I have to probably take a look to see if I could dive into that one a little bit more. Thank you.
For sure. I've read that one. Yeah, I don't think that has anything to do with critical race theory, although it is interesting. Okay, so he's credited with starting this around the 1970s. And then, like I said, I think it became more popular in the mid-90s. It maybe started to really catch on. But yeah, I think we talked about it briefly here before, once or twice. Kimberly Crenshaw, I think, gets mentioned quite a lot with that also. But yeah, That was, again, all of that was in context of the his O.J. Simpson response. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, guests and call listeners and Gus. I seem to be having some trouble. I don't know if it's the race soldiers or just the white supremacists, but they're giving me a hard time and when I'm logging into Twitter. So I don't know when the shows are on and I don't have the credentials. And also I wanted to make a comment on what Red said and what Bean Toronto said. This is the victim from Canada. I was hearing the gentleman as he was speaking, and I did find that he would rephrase the question into his own words so he could answer the question the way how he thought fit, changing the original question from what the callers originally intended. And that's something that I've always had difficulty in detecting. When I hear like an all-white person say something that may sound silly or confusing, or if a person that's classified as white, they're saying something that may cause me to be confused, and sometimes it's hard to detect when it's happening. So I think after hearing what Bean Toronto said and what Red said, I think that's a really good foundation for me to follow. And I can follow up with Mr. Fuller's book and with the counter-racist word guide, because that's really what the counter-racist word guide is, because his philosophy is that words are tools. And that's how we have to do it if we're going to practice counter-racism as a philosophy and also as a practice and as a way of living. So I wanted to pose the question to anybody, if anyone has any suggestions of how I could figure out how to solve this problem. Because I'm having trouble with my login to Twitter and I'm not able to see what shows on.
Wow.
Thank you.
Well. Let's see. Agreement on the use of words to confuse people, very common. I am not an expert on social media snafus, although I have experienced some of those this week, today specifically myself. That caused my own array of problems and disgust. So I am in the same boat, forgive the metaphor, bottom of that boat, griping about social media and things not working correctly on the platforms. You can always see if it's just broadcast time, that's on lots of different platforms. So I guess if Twitter is not behaving correctly, if it's just what time the program is going to broadcast, that is always posted on Facebook. Should be a Black Talk Radio Network. I guess it would be a Twitter if you can access there, but at minimum, all three of those locations should have it, like, if not, you know, the day of, sometimes the day before, the exact time, different, you know, time zone, all that good stuff, who the guest is going to be in detail. So if it's not working, not loading, boop, just go take a look. Let me see what's on Facebook. Let me see what's on Black Talk Radio. Information should be there, time, date, call-in number, all of those details. But unfortunately, I know the disgust challenge of social media not cooperating and or other platforms not cooperating. I'm very, very familiar with that today and this week acutely.
Yes, sir, because in particular why I brought it up, I thought that they may be trying to cause a situation where I may assume something that is incorrect, and then I'd bring it to another victim of racism and start causing a conflict between them as a means to cause confusion, because that's, they seem to do that a lot. Because what's happening is that I actually can't see for the cows page because it says that it's blocked. So I immediately went into codification and I started to think about, okay, what could be the problem? So I started to ask my own self questions. So I immediately saw maybe they got my credentials, my login credentials, because what has happened in the past, they got my credentials for my Apple, and then they made purchases to get me upset. And now because your the cows page on Twitter is not working. I mean, I can't see it. It says that it's blocked. So that's kind of what's happening, sir.
I'll go. Make a comment. Oh, Britt, yes, ma'am.
With that, you might want to try to the person, from the caller from Canada. You either may want to try to just change your password on Twitter if you can log in, like stop following the show and then try to refollow again instead if you're blocked. Another thing is that you may, if you're using an app, if you said maybe you have, like you said something about Apple, so if you have an iPhone, just delete the whole app and then just re-download it again. Those are just a couple suggestions. I'll meet my line.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Gus, and thank you very much, caller. I deeply appreciate you, and I'll mute my line.
Red is much more informed on the iPhone gadgetry and what have you than Gus T. I'm still in the Neanderthal era myself. Much obliged for Red in Ohio for the suggestions. Do we have other folks' suggestions and or comments they wanted to get in? Assume folks are satisfied. Grand. Love the questions and thinking we're talking to someone who is practicing racism, white supremacy. I think that is super important when talking to anyone classified as white. We're already thinking, not surprised, already thinking this person is probably going to be doing things to practice racism, white supremacy. That's not a surprise. Just on this platform, I do just want to make sure I'm always, the goal is try to make sure I can get to everybody. If we have a guest and folks take time out of their schedule to call in, I want to, as much as I can, try to make sure I can get everyone, if they want to get a question in, to make sure we can get to everybody. So just keep that in mind. Try to make sure we get everyone an opportunity to question a suspected racist. We'll be here Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I'm so excited. Mark Furman comes to the witness stand this week. I don't even think we'll get his full testimony on the witness stand this week because, well, one, he testifies twice, but two, it was kind of long in terms of how long he was on the stand. So that'll be this week and probably spill into next week. I have to double check to see Jeffrey Toobin. The acts of racism and deception are extraordinary. He did not include the segment about the video, the recital video last week. He, as I said, he might not have anything in the book about the EDTA. I don't know what he includes about the blood evidence. I just have lots of reason to be suspicious as we go down the stretch of the book through the trial and all that. So I'll be tuning in and paying lots of attention to see what gets included, what gets left out. Same thing with the television series. He said he watched one of the documentaries on it. I was thinking, I mean, was he talking about the run of his life? Because he said plural documentaries. I don't know if he meant like the ESPN series and the run of his life because they came out the same year. But neither here nor there. Any of that tripe that you watch, white supremacy propaganda, that's what you should be thinking. White supremacy propaganda. I think Jeffrey Toobin is affiliated with all of them. So if you watch any of that, white supremacy propaganda. Looking forward to Thursday. Much obliged for folks' participation. Hopefully it was worthy of your Tuesday evening. Sobriety would be best. They have that so many times in the text. I think I read some of the excerpts where they talked about drunken white mobs going to attack. I'm sure there was some of that at the Capitol siege as well, probably in Michigan when they were doing all that to go kidnap the governor, kidnap and execute the governor. But sobriety would be best. That way we can have our brain computer working at maximum efficiency to solve problems. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled every time we are in a vehicle. I still recommend hunkering down. It is kind of dangerous for many, many. Mob spirit is still running rampant. Main theme for why we even talked to Professor Dre to begin with. Mob spirit is running rampant in 2021. If you go out, you see any white people, really anybody, white or non-white, but particularly any white people, they're being loud, hostile. This is not a time for verbal confrontation. Want to be thinking of an exit strategy? If you need to call enforcement officers, if you think that's warranted, do that as you are exiting. You should be thinking mob spirit. They could have 5-20 other whites with them who are armed, ready for conflict. You probably did not leave your residence prepared for mortal combat. If that is the case, let's try to avoid this as best we can. Sober, hunkering down if we can. If you got to go out, something serious, be very alert, very mindful about what's happening around you. If you're having, or if anybody's being loud, what have you, just being very alert, aware of your environment. You are buckled, driver or passenger. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. One, we want to make sure that we are paying attention to what's happening around us. Two, let's try as best we can to minimize contact with the Mark Furmans of the known universe. Just doing the small things as best we can, being sober, being buckled, not on the cell phone, that type of thing. I think Dr. Kanban would probably say, try to avoid being out really late if you can help it too. Like once it's dark, really try to stay inside. All that said, Creator, we ask if you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. No name calling. No name call. Jeffrey Toobin sitting up lying on Johnny Cochran, having him name call Chris Darden in the courtroom. No name calling. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.